From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And you can rest assured that I will adhere to every order and every instruction that this court indicates for me to follow. And that's my word as a Vietnam vet and as a man.
Today, Geronimo Pratt joins us in the studio, Geronimo Gijaga, attorney Johnny Cochran, and Stuart Hanlon. Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Gijaga. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Citizens in Yugoslavia have escalated their campaign to oust Slobodan Milosevic. They've issued an ultimatum for him to step down as president and are staging massive protests, largely ignoring police. Angry crowds marched on the parliament building in Belgrade today. Some tried to fight their way inside. They were driven back by police who fired tear gas. But in some places, the crowds have been too big for police to even try to stop. In one town, protesters used a front-end loader to push aside sand trucks that police had set up as barricades. A Belgrade rally set for today will coincide with the ultimatum deadline. An opposition leader says if Milosevic doesn't step aside, quote, a flame will engulf the whole of Belgrade. A Yugoslav judge, meantime, says there will have to be all new elections. He has nullified the elections that took place last week. This news from Jerusalem. With the death toll at 65, Israel has withdrawn dozens of tanks from two West Bank flashpoints. The gesture is the result of a verbal agreement reached between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in Paris. But there's no deal on paper, and it's not clear yet if the bloodshed is over. Although it's been relatively quiet so far today, the violence in the Palestinian areas tends to intensify in the afternoons and evenings. Again, that death toll of 65, overwhelmingly, it's Palestinians who have been killed by Israeli fire. The New York Times today reports that a federal probe has determined that an elite undercover unit of the police department engaged in racial profiling while conducting an aggressive campaign of street searches. The inquiry began just weeks after the 1999 shooting death of Amadou Diallo, the unarmed African immigrant killed by four members of the police department's street crime unit. The U.S. Attorney's Office is meeting with the mayor's office to try to negotiate changes that would avert a lawsuit. If talks fail, the Justice Department could go to court and ask a judge to order broad changes in the operations of the unit and possibly oversight by a federal monitor. A federal appeals court yesterday granted expedited review of a case brought by Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader and voters challenging the corporate financing of the presidential debates. The lawsuit, filed in federal district court in Boston in June, seeks to strike down Federal Election Commission regulations, which have allowed a small handful of U.S. corporations to contribute millions of dollars to help stage the debates. If successful, the case could have a dramatic impact on the structure of the remaining presidential debates this month. The hearings begin today. The executive director of Catholic Social Services has resigned amid allegations the agency did little to help refugees in its charge who were placed in crime-ridden, rodent-infested buildings. Pam Buckmaster had been executive director since 1993. She resigned this week after news reports of the refugees living in squalor. The archdiocese moved 56 refugees out of one apartment complex Sunday after learning of the deplorable conditions in Atlanta. The hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica has stretched over a populated city for the first time after ballooning to a new record size. This according to New Zealand scientists. Previously, the hole had only opened over Antarctica and the surrounding ocean. Toxic pollution that's mysteriously entered Canada's pristine Arctic region has now been linked to air emissions from specific municipal waste incinerators, cement kilns, and industrial plants in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. This according to a new study released earlier this week. And it's an issue that has been debated for years. Though Puerto Ricans can vote in the presidential primaries, they cannot vote in the general election. Today, a federal appeals court is being asked to change that, a request that, if granted, would let 2.4 million voters in Puerto Rico help choose between Al Gore and George W. Bush. The plaintiffs argue they are being denied a right available to other citizens, but the Justice Department maintains the U.S. Constitution allows electors for the Electoral College to be picked only by those who live in states, not by those in U.S. territories. Congress made Puerto Ricans U.S. citizens in 1917. The territory has 3.5 million residents. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And there's going to be a lot of folks watching this appeals court decision or trial happening in Boston beginning today. Clearly, this federal judge that ruled that the 3.8 million, actually, citizens of Puerto Rico do have the right to vote in this presidential election. Of course, the judge is going against longtime Supreme Court precedents, and most Americans who don't know the Puerto Rico situation don't realize there's a whole body of Supreme Court decisions called the Insular Decisions, whereby the Supreme Court, in essence, legalized the holding of colonies by the United States. And actually, it was the same Supreme Court that decided the Dred Scott decision. It was in the 1901 case, Bounds versus Bidwell, where the Supreme Court ruled by a 5-4 majority that Puerto Rico was a possession of the United States, but was not part of the United States. And as such, ever since that time, basically the position of the U.S. government was that any rights that the people of Puerto Rico have are rights that Congress deemed to give them, not rights that they naturally have as U.S. citizens. And of course, so this U.S. district judge who ordered that Puerto Ricans be allowed to vote in this presidential election, I suspect will be overturned by the Federal Appeals Court in Boston based on this long history of unjust decisions by the Supreme Court. It still is throwing a little wrench into the both political parties with the possibility even that a whole new group of citizens might be allowed to vote just a few weeks from now in the November election for president.
Well, Juan, today we're also going to go back in history to a case that could also affect our future and informs the way we look at this country today. We're going to go back to the Democracy Now! Archives 3 years ago to June 11th, 1997. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And you can rest assured that I will adhere to every order and every instruction that this court indicates for me to follow. And that's my word as a Vietnam vet and as a man.
Former Black Panther Geronimo Pratt is free after 27 years in prison. This after evidence surfaced that his accuser was a police and FBI informant. That was Democracy Now! 3 years ago, and we're going to continue with the report on that day, the day after Geronimo Pratt was freed.
By young and old, each and every generation fought a Vietnam train with green beret till the secret war turned here the game. Came home to find he fought in the wrong military. Truth turned him into a revolutionary. He gonna teach my people how to defend themselves. Show them the other side of the white man's hell. Self-defense will keep us alive till we can figure out how to straighten our lives. Help my people, that's number one. Show them not to have fear of the gun. Force people, a fighter, to the enemy.
A song about Geronimo Pratt outside his courtroom yesterday. After 27 years in prison, former Black Panther Party leader Geronimo Pratt is free. To loud cheers from his family and supporters, Geronimo walked out of a Santa Monica, California courtroom yesterday after a judge released him on $25,000 bail, just 12 days after reversing his 1972 murder conviction. Judge Everett Dickey ruled after hearing new evidence that the chief witness against Geronimo Pratt was a police and FBI informant who lied under oath. Chris Richard was at the courtroom yesterday. He filed this report for Pacifica radio station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Bail will be set at $25,000.
It was a joyful scene at a Santa Ana courtroom as Superior Court Judge Everett Dickey granted a request by Pratt's defense team and set bail at a figure matching the quarter century Pratt spent in prison. Ever since his conviction for a murder during an $18 street robbery in Santa Monica, Pratt has claimed that he was a victim of a law enforcement frame-up, and evidence has steadily mounted that he might be correct. First, his defense team uncovered evidence that the former Black Panther leader had been targeted in the infamous FBI program dubbed COINTELPRO, a program of dirty tricks launched in the late 1960s and aimed at destabilizing anti-war and black power groups. They uncovered evidence that FBI agents may have known Pratt was attending Panther meetings in Oakland on the day of the killing, but concealed that knowledge. Then, last year, district attorney's investigators acknowledged that the star prosecution witness against Pratt, former Panther Julio Butler, was a paid informant for their office. During the original trial, Butler had claimed that he had never been a law enforcement informant. A state panel asked Judge Dickey to investigate the new revelations, and Dickey set an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Pratt should get a new trial. During the hearing, Pratt's attorneys established that Butler was an informant not only for the DA, but for the Los Angeles Police Department, the Sheriff's Department, and the FBI. 2 weeks ago, Judge Dickey said the jury needed to know that to render a fair verdict. He ordered a new trial. Today, Pratt stood in court to offer thanks.
Good morning, Judge Dickey. I just wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your fair and courageous ruling and assure you that any further proceedings in this case, I'll be the first one here because I've been trying to resolve the merits of this case for all of these years to find out who killed Mrs. Olson, not any technicalities to try to put it off. And I am so happy that you've given me this chance to finally expose the truth about who killed Mrs. Olson. And you can rest assured that I will adhere to every order and every instruction that this court indicates for me to follow. And that's my word as a Vietnam vet and as a man.
After bail was set, an exuberant Johnny Cochran, Pratt's attorney at the original trial, called his client a model of courage.
I think you can see where it's so very heartfelt that the picture of Geronimo Pratt that's been put out is not an accurate picture. What he is, really, is an American hero. He is a decorated veteran. He is a person who has character and integrity, and in the face of this wrongful conviction, where the state used its mighty resources to convict him unfairly, he never wavered in his innocence. And you saw at the end when he spoke, the strength that emanates from this man. And I think that he can be a real positive force in this country as we move forward. When you are falsely accused, to have the strength and the endurance to spend your first 8 years in solitary confinement, he did what some of us only talk about. And so we're real proud to have had the opportunity to represent.
But Stuart Hanlon, who also has represented Pratt for the last quarter century, called today's ruling a mixed victory.
It's a great day for justice and for Geronimo, but it's not a great day for our legal system. People have said, does this justify the legal system? And the answer is no. The legal system that kept him in jail for 27 years for something he didn't do could not be justified by one judge having the guts to do the right thing. So we are exuberant today. It's been a very long struggle, but it's a great ending. We're writing the final chapter. The district attorney is not writing the last chapter. The police department is not writing the last chapter. We are. Geronimo Pratt is writing the last chapter of his story, and it starts today in Orange County when he leaves. And we say to everybody, right on, let's go get him out.
In 1972, COINTELPRO apparently was succeeding in destabilizing the Panthers. The organization was riven by factionalism, and the internal tension was rendered even worse by Panther founder Huey Newton's drug abuse. Kathleen Cleaver was one of very few Panthers to defy Newton's orders and testify in Pratt's defense. She swore then that he was in Oakland attending Panther meetings around the time of the killing, but she couldn't remember exactly whether Pratt was at the meeting on the day of the killing. Only 2 years ago did other Panthers step forward to solidify Pratt's alibi. Cleaver says that over the years, she's grown weary of the legal system treating Pratt's case as different from all others.
What I said is that the time that I've observed the way the courts have handled this case, it has never been treated as a matter of law. It's been treated as an aberration and as if the law doesn't apply because this is a Black Panther threat to society and we can just ignore the law. Finally, I've seen a judge who is willing to treat this case as a legal matter and apply the law as it existed before he was tried.
Why couldn't it happen in L.A.?
Because it's a political cesspool driven by hatred and paranoia of Blacks in general and Panthers in particular.
But today, Pratt's family focused on their immediate joy. His wife, Ashaki, already is making plans.
I feel wonderful. Wonderful. It's been a long time coming. I was thinking about how long it's going to take us to get him out of there so we can get to my daughter's graduation.
As for Pratt, he too says he wants to move forward. Moments after walking out of the Orange County jail, he urged the public to remember the plight of other prisoners, notably Native American activist Leonard Peltier, who has been incarcerated for nearly as long as Pratt. And Pratt says he bears no hard feelings against his old adversary Julio Butler, the former Panther who played a pivotal role in winning a conviction against him a quarter century ago.
What do you have to say to Mr. Butler?
What do you have to say to Mr. Butler? I wish him well, and I hope that he can wake up out of that stupor or whatever he's in and begin telling the truth about his puppet role, his House Negro status, and so forth and so on, and come and tell the truth. And even if he's done, the truth is going to come out. It took me 26 years.
Right now, Pratt says he only wants to catch up on his family life. His 14-year-old son, Hiroji, graduates from middle school next Friday, and his daughter, 18-year-old Shona, graduates from high school in Marin County today. At the jailhouse gate, Pratt jumped into a waiting car for a dash to the airport. He says he wants to be present at that graduation. This is Chris Richard reporting for KPFK.
And we thank Chris Richard for that report 3 years ago, the day after June 10, 1997, when Geronimo Gijaga Pratt was freed after 26 years, 7 months in prison, 8 of those years in solitary confinement. Since that time, over these last 3 years, Geronimo Gijaga has won a $4.5 million settlement against the City of Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Police Department, and the FBI. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we are joined in the studio now by Geronimo Gijaga, as well as his attorneys, Johnny Cochran and Stuart Hanlon. Geronimo, 3 years later, how does it feel today?
It feels good to be able to come to WBI and thank everyone and to see that you're still struggling for the freedom of others, you know, and to see old comrades such as yourself.
And what are you doing today?
Continuing to try to contribute to whatever I can contribute to. The main thing is to freeing the rest of the comrades who are left in prison. That's the main thing. You know, I'm down there with my mother in Louisiana, so I have to operate from that field of struggle. Okay.
Well, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to talk about all sorts of issues, including why COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program, is relevant today. Our guests again, Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, attorneys Johnny Cochran and Stuart Hanlon. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk with our guests for today. Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, free now, 3 years ago, after almost 27 years in prison, 8 of those years in solitary confinement. Also joining us from the Bay Area is Stuart Hanlon, his longtime attorney and his first attorney, attorney Johnny Cochran.
Well, Geronimo, I'd like to welcome you and tell you I was mesmerized by the book as I was going through it last night, and especially what I loved was the history, your early history in Louisiana, because, of course, when I was in the Young Lords back in the 60s, and we had a lot of relationships with the Panthers, and you were out in California and always this sort of legendary figure that people on the East Coast heard about. The story of how you shaped your consciousness and the history of your growing up, and especially about the deacons, was something that I had no idea of until I read the book. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about growing up in Louisiana and what shaped your political consciousness, how you ended up in Vietnam.
Well, I grew up in segregation, and we had to deal with the terror from the Klan violence and, you know, other forms of ignorance from those peoples. But growing up in that kind of environment instilled in me a pride of or a sense of nationalism, that we can govern ourselves and we can protect ourselves, and we didn't need to be with anyone who didn't want to be with us. So out of that, I was part of a group that was selected by the elders to get military training to come back to the community, you know, and help protect it, relieve the old soldiers. It just so happened that when I was selected, Vietnam was happening, and I ended up in Vietnam and survived that two and a half tours. And when I came back, it was shortly after Martin Luther King was assassinated, so the black nation was more or less at one now with the just being fed up. Mm. And everyone was saying, look, we have to do something. So us young militant types were employed quite extensively throughout the nation. And so this is how I ended up in these cities, contributing what little I could contribute.
And when you say you were sent by the elders, as the book explains, there were people that, to the rest of folks in the white society in Louisiana, would look at the local barber, these old guys that would sit around and during the day and talk. But you had a whole different perspective on who they were and what they represented in the struggle for freedom.
Yes. Well, if you would meet them today, you would see in case of Jimmy Harris or Aloysius, you would think you were talking to what you would call an Indian, you know. Those traditions are still intact down throughout the South, where you respect your elders, you listen to your elders, and you heed their wisdom. And this is how I grew up.
And after you grew up and went to California, you got involved with politics of a different sort.
Well, I came here first. I came here, then I went to Chicago. Then I went back to Louisiana, and I was sent to Los Angeles to meet with this brother, this great brother named Apprentice Bunchy Carter, whose elder was kin to my elder. And we're all from Louisiana, like Johnny Cochran's father, and, you know, who are communicating among ourselves. So just like they needed someone to come teach how to run a mimeograph machine. Remember those back in the day? And you needed someone to come and teach education, culture. They also needed someone to come and teach how to defend oneself. And this was my calling.
And you got involved then with the Black Panther Party?
Well, with various organizations, including the Black Panther Party.
So yeah. How did you end up in a courtroom being tried for the murder of Carolyn Olson? She was killed playing on a Santa Monica tennis court with her husband in 1968. Mm-hmm. You were caught and charged when?
Well, I was arrested 2 years after that in 1970 in Dallas, Texas, where I was instrumental in helping to organize the first Black Panther chapter there in Dallas, Texas, and other parts of the South. I was charged because of a conspiracy by the government that was led by the Hoover, what we call the Hoover-Nixon regime, which was an illegal conspiracy directed against the entire left, entire movement.
Johnny Cochran, how did you get involved with Geronimo's case?
I was appointed by the court by Judge Kathleen Parker to represent Mr. Pratt in the murder case. I had met him and it sat alongside him in another case, the so-called Panther shootout case that took place in 1971 in L.A. It was then the longest trial ever. And all the Panthers were pretty much acquitted of all the charges in that, and it was a bogus case. The court then appointed me to represent him in the tennis court murder case.
And what happened in that first trial?
Well, it was an amazing trial. I mean, we came in there knowing and believing strongly that Geronimo Pratt was innocent. We sought to set out to prove that innocence, to establish an alibi. We ran into some problems in getting other Panther members to come and establish the alibi. Mr. Pratt was in Oakland at the time of these killings in December of 1968. None of the Panthers who were affiliated with or aligned with Huey Newton would come. So Kathleen Cleaver was in exile.
And that was because he had already been expelled?
Mr. Pratt had been expelled, and further, that right. The FBI had infiltrated him so much right. that they inculcated this kind of fear and distrust and whatever, and they wouldn't let him come testify. So we got Kathleen Cleaver to come back, and she was a great witness. She couldn't pin it down as much as we wanted to, but we still thought we'd won the case. Jury stays out like 12 days or more, and they're hopelessly deadlocked, but they end up convicting an innocent man. And it was all the things we didn't see that took place which caused that defeat.
Now, Geronimo, what did you tell your young attorney, Johnny Cochran, at the beginning? What did you think was going on? Why were you targeted?
Well, there was so much going on at the time. I was charged with so many murders. As I had indicated earlier, I was charged with the Tate LaBlanca murders. Well, I was picked up for it before Charles Manson. I was also picked up for another murder on the west side, in which this youngster went into a party and killed someone. And they would hold us without bail. So I was thinking at this time that this was another murder, another tactic they were using to keep me from making bail.
And what did you think of that, Johnny Cochran?
Well, I thought that basically, you know, throughout our trial especially, and Mr. Pratt would always say, they're out to get me there. And I would always say, well, what do you mean by they? What do you mean by they? Who is this they? And, of course, he was right. And as I said, I learned a lot from representing Mr. Pratt, you know, that a little paranoia is healthy. That even paranoid people have real enemies. And, of course, he was right, it was the FBI. It was the counterintelligence program. And, Amy, how we found this out was through the good offices, really, of Stuart Hanlon. In the intervening years after the conviction, through the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to find out a number of things. That this man, Julius Butler, who was the star witness for the prosecution, who got on the stand and said that Mr. Pratt confessed to him and was asked by me, are you now, have you ever been an informant for the FBI or any other agency? And he said no. He said no, unequivocally no. He lied. At that point, he said that he'd informed 33 times. And in fact, he was an informant for the LAPD and the LA County DA's office. He was their confidential informant. They'd done that. They had wiretapped our phones. They had had informants in the defense environs, that meaning that somewhere in our offices they knew everything we were going to do. They had failed to give us Brady material, that is exculpatory material, where the husband of this lady who was shot had positively identified two other people. They kept that from us. They did all these things in an effort to neutralize, which meant kill, destroy, lock up forever, Geronimo Pratt at the behest of J. Edgar Hoover.
Of course, at that time, you were already developing a reputation in L.A. I think in the book it says that you told Geronimo, I've already won like 10 murder cases. I'm going to win this one as well. But you had no idea even then the depth of what the law enforcement officials, what extremes they'd resort to be able to get a person they wanted to get.
Well, it was incomprehensible to me to believe they would go that far. I thought in a fair fight we would win. And we would have won in a fair fight, but it wasn't a fair fight. And I didn't realize the depth to which your own government could turn on a citizen, a decorated, authentic American hero, two tours in Vietnam, but yet because of the fact that he was a leader, a charismatic in his own right, bright, a tactician, they saw him as a threat, and they were willing to do whatever. And not only did they do this to convict him, but then they held him basically incommunicado for the first 8 years in solitary confinement, and then they still, even at the very end, when Stuart Hanlon and I argued this case to that judge in 1997, we had convinced everybody in the courtroom, we thought, that Pratt had gotten no trial. I turned to the DA, whom I'd known when I was a DA, and said, join us in asking to let this man out. They still wouldn't. In fact, even after they lost, they appealed it to the appellate court, and they court ruled unanimously against them. So the cover-up, the attempt to keep this man locked up continued to the very end. They didn't give us anything, and then we sued him after that.
Stuart Hanlon, you joined the case after Geronimo Gijaga was convicted. He was sentenced to life in prison. In fact, the death penalty wasn't in place in that time. If it was?
Yes, he would have gotten the death penalty. Another reason we're opposed to it. You would have at least received it.
How did you get involved with the case?
Well, I had just, well, in law school, I'd come out from here, from New York. I'd been at Columbia, where a lot of my political views had been developed. And I went into law to represent people who were attacked by our government, primarily non-white political people or poor people, poor white people. And Geronimo's case, I became aware of it. I met him. And not only, you know, with personally, he was a man who I immediately respected and grew to love. But politically, I mean, I think we couldn't call it COINTELPRO then, but we knew that one of the greatest threats to what was happening in our country was the government targeting people because of what they said or what they believed and giving the police carte blanche to do what they want to those people. And it still is a great threat to everybody, to democracy. You know, if the police get to do that, there'll be no democracy now, you know, if they get to run this country. So that's what's going on then, and it was really something that drew me to him. And I think people should understand. I mean, now Geronimo, Johnny's here. He's always been here. We've got a lot of publicity. Back in 1975, there was nothing. It was law students, and Geronimo was, you know, just languishing in the hole, and there was nobody knew of him. And just a group of young people with Johnny's help just kept on going. And we used the Freedom of Information Act to get the government's own records.
Well, one of the things that amazed me again in the book is that, of course, many people on the outside in general American society, once someone is sentenced to prison, it's like they've died. You know, they've forgotten. But, of course, prison has enormous life, vitality, battles, and struggles that go on inside them. And as I looked through the book, the story of Geronimo's sort of development from, and the book, of course, is called Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. But what amazed me was your development from this targeted inmate who spent all this time in solitary to, in essence, you became a leader of the prison, where even the prison authorities began to rely on you to be able to help resolve conflicts that develop within the jail. And, of course, as often happens with political prisoners, they are respected and admired by the other prisoners in the jail. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, that was quite an experience, especially after coming from Vietnam and the struggle on the streets, going into prisons with all of the problems, with the divide and conquer techniques, and, of course, with the institutionalized racism, right in the wake of George Jackson, the uprising. And
George Jackson killed in prison.
Right, who was murdered. And Rochelle McGee and Jonathan, Christmas and McLean at the Marin County Courthouse. And as Stuart mentioned earlier, the SLA and all of these things, then the advent of the BGF and so forth and so on. And the problems with the Mexican Mafia, the Nuestra Familia, the Aryan Brotherhood, just madness every day was abounding in those prisons. Me being, say, arisen, descending to the top, at the bottom of that pack, was an unenviable position again. Things just happened to develop that way, and I began to try to organize as best I could. I worked with the Vietnam vets. We were all were serving, 187s, and we organized pretty good.
187s?
And, that's a penal code for murder, first degree murder. And through that, we were able to get to a lot of the younger prisoners to get them organized in a way they could change things also.
His own role there. I mean, you to know what he was like, the visiting room is where all the races got together, all the different people in prison, and that's where I would see him. And he'd come in, even in the early 70s, and no matter what the race, no matter what the people, the whites, the Chicanos, the Latinos, the Asians, their families would come up and say hi to him. It was unheard of. Geronimo would come in the visiting room, and everybody would say hello to him, which meant a huge amount. It wasn't just hi. It didn't happen with anybody else. And it's just, even the guards, even in the beginning, the baseline guards, even though they would really mess with him, had a real respect for him. It was really quite amazing to see.
Geronimo, before you were set free, 26 years and 7 months after you went to prison, you were in solitary for 8 years.
Yes.
We can say that, but what does that mean? What is life like in solitary? Where were you kept?
Well, I was kept in the hole in San Quentin and Folsom. I started in a hole in Dallas, Texas, where I was busted, and then on to the holes in Los Angeles County Jail, which is like nightmares when you're talking about the holes in Texas and L.A. County, the old county jail, and then on to the holes in state prisons. But what it means is that this country tortures people. And right now, Hugo Pinnell is going into his 27th year in the hole. Woodfox and Wallace and King, who are in Angola State Prison in Louisiana, are going into their 23rd year in the hole. So when you talk about 8 years in the hole, and you look at this ongoing today, it's hard for me to even talk about those 8 years because it's happening right now.
What is the hole? What does it look like?
They vary in different states. They are all punitive. They are torturous. They are everything bad that you can think of. They put the worst mindless idiots over those sections in prison where they can really, you know, mess over you.
Do you have a bed?
No. When some now, they have beds because of litigation. But it's even that is a slab of concrete, like resembling a gravestone. So they're very in
the toilet, a hole in the floor?
Yes. The holes I was in, the toilet hole in the floor initially, and until Stu and Johnny, we had a suit, Johnny, as Stu may want to talk about that, was based on a law that derived out of the Reconstruction era in this history after slavery was, quote-unquote, officially abolished. This the Congress of 1871 enacted this jurisdiction called the USC United States Code 42, 1983 lawsuit that was hidden from us for years and years and years. Well, the Civil Rights Movement brought it out, and then the prison movement through George Jackson, Rushell, and lawyers like Brian Glick and Dennis Cunningham and others, we all got together and we revived this. And through that vehicle, we were able to finally get straight to the federal court, in which we were our conditions in the hole were improved. You know.
How many hours a day are you kept in this single cell?
24 hours a day. And then after the second year, it became 23 and a half. They would let you out for a half an hour.
Well, when we come back from our break, we'll find out how you kept your sanity. You're listening to Geronimo Gijaga. He was found guilty of murdering a woman, Carolyn Olson, who was a peace activist. Then he was exonerated. There is a book about him now, just been published by Jack Olson, called Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. Also in the studio with us, Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran, Geronimo Gijaga's attorneys. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! By the way, if you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we go to the sounds of that day on June 10th, 1997, when Geronimo Pratt was released from prison.
That I'm innocent of any crimes of murder, and further expose the truth of COINTELPRO and illegal practices of the Hoover Nixon regime.
That's right.
So I want to thank you again.
I want you to have this. What are you going to be doing next?
I don't just feel the breeze for it's hard to describe. You know, for 27 years, and they give me the worst that you can ever conceive. And I still have brothers like Rochelle McGee, Hugo Pernell, that's still
right.
in the hole.
That's right.
And they have no reason in the hole. Beautiful brothers. Romaine Fitzgerald, the only Panther we lost to death row for a murder he didn't commit, and everybody in the community knows it. And that's one thing I want to say. When someone like Johnny Cochran comes and tell you that I'm representing this man from the community, that means the community has empowered him. Johnny knows what's going on. Johnny is deeply rooted in the community. So all of this that Garcetti is saying, I contribute to the power of the people, that the continuing struggle, that we will never relent when we're faced with injustice. I can contribute personally to Stu Hamlin.
Geronimo Gijaga on the steps of the Orange County Courthouse, June 10th, 1997, after he had served almost 27 years in prison, eight of them in the hole. Our guests also attorneys Stuart Hanlon and Johnny Cochran. Stuart Hanlon, who has come to be involved with the Sarah Jane Olson case, a Bay Area attorney. Johnny Cochran, of course, known for representing O.J. Simpson, also now Puffy Combs. During the O.J. Simpson case, Johnny Cochran, you said that the real story, the real case that people have to know about, because he was still in prison at the time, was Geronimo Pratt. Why?
Because it obsessed me. Because no matter what happened in my career, no matter what we did, he was still locked up, being held by his government wrongfully. And so it was something that we lived with every day. And I took every opportunity to speak about it. And I remember being interviewed, because we were really focused on the Simpson defense, but I remember being interviewed over the lunch hour by a lady from GQ. And she asked me about what was really important. And I said, well, you know, it's important what you're doing in your job. But that case was what I was thinking was important to all of us. And at that time I said that the prosecutor, who was then now a judge, a Superior Court judge for L.A. County, wasn't fit to be on the bench because we had known, Stuart had uncovered in 1977 that this man, Julius Butler, was an informant, but the courts chose to turn a blind eye to that. They became part of the conspiracy, too, in the cover-up. So I took it upon myself to say he wasn't fit to be on the bench. Turned out that was kind of prophetic because later on, when we got a hearing finally in 1996, they used that, among other things, to transfer us out of Los Angeles County. And that's how we got Judge Dickey. The plan, however, was to send us to this conservative kind of Orange County area. But we got a judge who understood what it meant to be a judge, an honorable man, Everett Dickey, who had the courage to listen to the evidence and give us a hearing. And he was the one who was instrumental in getting Geronimo released. There were a couple other things we got. As you know, a DA's investigator, after 25 years, went right down in less than a minute, went into a safe, a locked safe, and found under B for Butler a card which said he was a confidential informant, their informant. Now, you can't tell us they couldn't have done that 25 years before, but that happened, and we got that. And then
Course, also, you got the testimony of a former FBI agent, Michael Swearingen. You know, because one of the things that amazes me about that the society doesn't understand, every organization of repression depends on human beings. And in every institution of repression, there are honest human beings who at one point or another feel something was wrong about what they did. Swearingen was involved in COINTELPRO, right?
And he was, in fact, and I'll let Stuart talk about this, but it is, you're right about that. And Swearingen retired, and at some point he came forward and still tell you about what he had to say.
He had been involved in many what he called black bag tricks of the FBI, dirty tricks, not murders, but illegal robberies and setups. And at the end, I think what turned him, what he said, he was called to go to the SLA shootout in L.A. in 1974, where the six members were killed.
Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yeah, Symbionese Liberation Army. And he saw the joys with the other FBI agents and LAPD went to go there, knowing they were going to kill these people. And he just walked away. And I don't think really ever came back. And he one thing he showed us is the proof that Geronimo, the FBI, knew he was in Oakland at the time of the murder, because it was the first time he ever found logs and records of wiretaps that were missing. And the fact that they were missing the wiretaps of the Oakland office and L.A. office during this two-week period at the time of the murder, I think the office were proof that they knew he was there.
So really it was the FBI wiretaps that helped to save you, Geronimo Giugiaro, because you were a leader working in the Black Panther Party, right? And they were tracking everywhere you went. And if you were up in Oakland, they were tracking your phone calls and Swearingen and seeing that they were gone.
Right.
And also later.
But, see, but I think that has to sink into the listeners. The FBI, by its own wiretaps and surveillance, knew that you couldn't possibly have committed that crime, and yet they went along with and participated actively in the framework.
I mean, I think people have to understand the greatest threat to our society is letting law enforcement run wild with the approval of their higher-ups, whether it's J. Edgar Hoover or Bill Clinton or Janet Reno, whoever it is. When we give law enforcement unlimited power, unbridled power, democracy falls apart. And that's one of the major lessons of Geronimo's case, because people have to understand what law enforcement does when they have unlimited power. They will always do the same thing. They will do, the ends will always justify the means, because their ends are to get their view to take over. And it's just incredibly destructive. And, you know, it's just, and two other policemen came forward who were wonderful. They were old men at this point, two LAPD officers, two African-American officers came forward, and finally, with a lot of encouragement from Johnny, who knew them, finally told the truth that Butler had been an informant for them. And I just think they didn't want to end their careers with this lie on their record. So they were amazing.
But why, even with knowing that Butler was an informant, did that mean that what he said was a lie?
Well, I think that what happened was it meant the whole thing was a lie. What the judge had said, that if, and it was interesting because by this time, one of the jurors, Jeannie Hamilton, who had reluctantly changed her vote and voted for guilty, had said if they had known, imagine if a trial when you can cross-examine a witness and bring out the fact that you are an informant, you're working for the FBI, they put this case together, and have him say, no, I'm not that, no, I'm just being a good citizen, I'm just doing my civic duty. So it cut at the very heart of everything. So that's what made it. It affected his credibility. He lied about everything. I mean, we could then demonstrate that. And furthermore, we found out that his big testimony was he had this letter he'd supposedly written to protect himself. Well, the letter was written by the FBI. The FBI had the letter all the time. They set it up. They got it after he wrote it. So it was all part and parcel. And what we found out, as Stuart has mentioned, is that we found out that he'd been caught with a machine gun. He was working. He was worried about himself, and he was working off this case. The LAPD phonied up a report to cover for him, to get him out of that. And so he was working it off, and Pratt was the victim of that. And that's what happens in these courts. And you know, you got to, as Stuart says, the big thing and one of the messages we want to get out is that in all of our society, there's this issue of who polices the police. And the police are basically, the police officer on the beat and the others are the single most powerful figures in the justice system. More important, more powerful than the Supreme Court. Look at the New York Times today, where you see this racial profiling, why they stop and they search and they can shoot, and very little's done about it. So Geronimo Pratt is another result of that. So if we don't wake up and pay attention to this and learn a lesson, what's happening in Los Angeles now in this Rampart scandal, which is of epic proportions, and people just kind of like are going along with it, you know, kind of sitting there and like, well, you know, those guys were gang members. Well, gang members, they were framed, shot, maimed, and now they got to pay all this money, and people are kind of sitting down saying, well, you know, this is what happens. It's preposterous.
One of the I think, most emotional parts of the book, Geronimo, was when you end up in the same prison with Huey Newton years later. Huey, who of course was an icon to many of us in the 1960s, but who then clearly fell apart in the later years of his life. But and he's the guy who expelled you from the party, who called you every name in the book, and suddenly now you're in prison, and he is brought back. I think it was on a parole violation.
Yeah, it was a sad day to see him come.
And of course, everyone expected now you were a leader of the prison that you would, in one way or other, try to get retribution on Huey. And could you tell us a little bit about what happened?
it was sad to see Huey after all those years come in, after going through crack. He was it's a sad reflection of the man I had known. Huey was, I think, along with Eldridge, right at the middle of the essence of the center of the bullseye from COINTELPRO. Huey was always a great man, as with so many others who we are so quick to criticize without understanding the objective analysis. When you are targeted by COINTELPRO in such a way where there's someone is spending, say, $50,000 a week, you know, just to employ people to victimize you and to target you, even the strongest, it's hard to stand up under that. And I thought Huey, Eldridge, and so many others stood up pretty good under that. But it was sad. And Huey, when he come in, we didn't harm him. We talked to him, gave him vitamins, and exercised him, and he began to rejuvenate himself. And he became very remorseful. So he contacted Stu, and they had a press conference, and he refused to leave prison. He said because he felt personally responsible for telling the Panthers not to testify for me when they knew that I was up there. And so far as expulsion, at that time there was no more Black Panther Party, so everybody was expelling everybody. So he was expelled by someone, this person. So we don't look at it like that. We don't look at it as a Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver faction. In our view, maybe if we had more time, we could talk about that. But, it was sad to see Huey. And he, of course, was assassinated a year after he left. And strangely enough, he was trying to redeem himself in the community. And it's not strange to us that they would, get him out of the way now because he's getting healthy again. And he's had, Stu might want to talk about how he had talked to Stu about doing more to clear up all of the wrongs that he had done, you know.
Stu?
Yeah, I mean, came out from being in prison with Geronimo and really wanted to get re-involved in the political system, not the Democratic Party, you know, and try to organize the community again and get away from drugs. And, you know, he was, as Geronimo said, the government destroyed Huey Newton. You know, he was targeted and they got to him, and it was really sad. And at the end, he was just trying to help, and it just the government continued to go after him.
Geronimo, we asked about you being in the hole, but didn't get to find out for 8 years how you kept up your strength.
Well, you are forced when you are deprived of food. Usually people go on a fast themselves, but if no one gives you food, then you're on a fast. When your body is deprived of this junk that we call food, it goes to a cleansing process. Through a cleansing process, it's very, it's like a catharsis. And if you're not aware of this and you're holding on and you're maintaining, what you're doing is you're practicing TM, you're practicing astral projection, all of those things that I later came to learn about after the fact. But it happened to me naturally that I was on bread and water for a long time, so I would just throw the bread back out. And, it was a lot of violence back then, so my body was deteriorating, and I would find myself in this longer state of reverie, like meditation. And through that, I came at peace with myself from within, where I detached. I couldn't get nothing, so I wouldn't want for anything. So when you detach from everything, you find a freedom that you didn't know existed. So,
To those who say that the system has proved that it works by ultimately you being exonerated, what do you say?
I'll say that's not a that's the evidence to the contrary, that it doesn't work too well. All of my 7 years of my 20s, every minute of my 30s, every second of my 40s were taken away from me. If that's a system working, then I think something wrong with your thinking.
And, of course, Johnny Cochran, white America knows you as the O.J. Simpson lawyer, but African Americans and Latinos knew you for years before that. as a, someone who stood up to the system in cases of injustice and knew about your reputation and your battle before then. What lesson did you get out of Geronimo's case?
Well, I think that I learned a lot myself during this whole process of always questioning the official version. The fact the government says it doesn't make it so. In fact, you should question, you should scrutinize it. You should hold everybody up to scrutiny because things are not as they appear. That the government has an agenda very often, and you have to be very much aware of that. And I think through the years, we proved that if you could, I think the other message was that you can fight City Hall. It does take a very long time, and it's very slow and very painful, but you can fight it. And I think that's what we tried to prove in this case. And ultimately, it was important for us for final closure not to just win and walk away. We had to bring that other lawsuit for violation of his civil rights. That was important for us. That was the exclamation point. It wasn't about the money, although the money was only a tangible way of having the FBI saying, okay, we were wrong after all these years. Very hard to make the government say they're sorry. They don't say they're sorry. So what you do is you make them pay some money, and that's how I guess they say they're sorry.
And Geronimo, as you listen to George Bush and Al Gore debate, what do you think as you watch them run for the presidency?
Well, I think about all of those years in the hole in prison, dodging bullets, knife thrusts, and the sisters and brothers that's still in there, while all of these demagogic politicians out here running their mouth and continuing to be a part of this genocidal project program that's going on, that's killing the movement, the most vibrant, energetic, you know, what we need to continue us on, to keep us continue on. That's, my mind is on the comrades in prison mostly, so you forgive me for not being well-versed in the matters of America's politics.
George Bush has presided over more than 140 executions.
He's a serial killer. Right.
I want to thank you for being with us, Geronimo Gijaga, Stuart Hanlon, Johnny Cochran. The new book out on them, Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt by Jack Olson.
And every listener should get that book.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julian Aldrich, Sidruck Franklin. Special thanks to Deepa Fernandez, Robert Knight, Frank Stoltz, Brian DeShazer, and Mark Torres. That does it for today's show. If you want to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
As one, black and strong, like the stories of people on small streets, giving and saying.
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and this